As we continue to navigate these unprecedented times, KCBS is looking for answers to your questions about the coronavirus pandemic and all the issues around it. Each weekday morning at 9:20, we're doing an Ask an Expert segment each day, trying to focus on a different part of the big picture. And today, focusing on COVID-19 treatment, what we're learning about this disease. To answer your questions, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Dr. Brian Schwartz, a physician specializing in the treatment of infectious diseases. He is a professor at the UCSF School of Medicine and is affiliated with Zuckerberg SF General Hospital. Dr. Schwartz, good morning. Thanks for the time, and how are you doing?
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, let me just start with kind of a general question for you now that we're several months into this thing. How do you feel things are? Stable? Scary? Somewhere in between?
If you asked me a number of weeks ago, I would say that I was feeling like we were moving in the right direction. But I think the recent events across the country with the rise in cases is very disturbing and scary. And I wish I was feeling better than I am right now.
And what about the kinds of cases? You know, early on, people were dying quickly, not so much lately. I know we have some questions getting to that specifically. But is there any sense you have of who you're seeing now?
I think we're still seeing a lot of patients who I can tell you from being in the hospital caring for patients just this weekend that there are still many patients who are getting ill and have severe disease requiring prolonged hospitalizations in the ICU, and people are still dying of this infection.
Well, let's get to the questions, and I have quite a long list this morning. And again, if something comes to mind during our segment, go ahead and send that email at askus@kcbsradio.com. Let's start with this one. How many days from a possible exposure does it take for the virus to, number one, replicate enough to show up on a test, and number two, replicate enough to normally show symptoms in someone?
So then the number of days from exposure to the onset of symptoms is definitely variable from person to person. We know that there are a certain percentage of people that will be exposed, infected, shed virus, contagious, but never have any symptoms. So that is one of the disturbing and challenging issues with this virus that's different from other diseases. I would say from the onset of exposure to first being contagious, it could probably be anywhere to 3 to 6 days. Although it varies from person to person. And then the onset of symptoms can be a little bit later, it can be a little bit sooner, but somewhere around that window.
Okay, next question. What does asymptomatic really mean? Does it mean that the person may develop symptoms as time goes by, or does it mean that the symptoms will be mild, or there will be no symptoms at all?
So there are two terms that you may have seen when people talk about COVID infection. There's the term asymptomatic, and we say that somebody's asymptomatic, that means they've been infected, they're contagious, but they never have any symptoms at all, and they resolve. The other term you may have heard is something called presymptomatic, and that we define as somebody who's infected, is contagious, has no symptoms on this day, but 4 days later goes on to develop symptoms, and we call that the presymptomatic period.
Okay, fair enough. And I guess the question then is that are there people who will never develop symptoms?
Yes, there will be people who, and I think we're still trying to better understand what percentage of the population this will happen in, but there will be definitely people who will be infected, are contagious, and never develop any symptoms.
Okay, next question. Let's see if I can get through this one. We hear more and more about people testing positive but with no symptoms. Isn't this a sign of herd immunity? How can a person develop antibodies without having the virus in the body? Yet if the antibodies work, won't they show no symptoms? I may have this a little bit confused here. The final part of the question was, if we had 100% herd immunity, will no one or everyone test positive? There's a lot to unpack there.
There is a lot to unpack there. So I want to start by going back to the idea that you could be infected, you could be shedding and be able to transmit infection to other people, be contagious, and never have symptoms. That is very different than somebody who has immunity. Let's say I was infected, my body's immune system has developed the ability to control the infection, I've cleared it. Then if I got exposed again later, I would not be infected. I probably would not be contagious and shedding to anybody, and so I would never have symptoms. Those are two very different scenarios. And then talking about the idea of herd immunity, we would need so many people to be infected and then develop immunity to get herd immunity, that there would be many, many people who would get very sick and die and be in the ICU to get there. So really our goal right now is to prevent the spread of disease and hopefully get to that point where we can get an effective vaccine.
Next question, is it true that the coronavirus has become much less lethal and is losing its potency? And does that explain why we have fewer daily deaths while cases are rising to record highs?
That is not true. The virus is still as potent and severe as it always has been. There are probably several factors that may make things look like that it's less lethal. A couple ideas around that are, one, as we detect more cases, early on our testing was more limited. So we would have everybody who came in and got tested was sick, and those people, a certain percentage of them would go on to die or go to the ICU. Now as our testing is expanded, and we may even be tested people with more symptoms, that total denominator of people that are being tested and being positive is bigger, and probably the number of people that are going on to die from it is going to be smaller. So it's just the total pool number of people that we're testing is bigger. And I think that's a disconnect. I think that a lot of the patients that are at higher risk, who are older, have other illnesses that put them at higher risk, are doing a good job of avoiding contact. So maybe the people that are getting infected tend to be lower risk for having death when they do get infected.
Okay. Next one. Early on, I heard that high blood pressure was thought to be an underlying condition. I'm 71 with high blood pressure controlled with daily meds. Is that still considered an underlying condition in addition to my age?
Hypertension, high blood pressure, is considered to be a risk factor for having more severe disease. Yes.
Okay. Can you ask your expert if anything new has been revealed about long-term internal damage post-COVID and whether asymptomatic people are also at risk as well as people who suffered with symptoms?
That is a great question. I think there's a lot that we still need to learn. I think that patients who have bad COVID and extensive lung disease, even if they're able to clear, probably have some lung damage and will take a long time to recover. And it's possible that they may have permanent scarring and damage to their lungs that will prevent them from being able to exercise and do things as well as they want to in the future. Tell me again the second part of that question.
The question of whether people who were asymptomatic but infected, yes, are susceptible to these sorts of things long term.
Great. I think it is not clear that patients who are asymptomatic will have any complications if they never have symptoms.
Okay, next question, and this is kind of the same question. Saw one report that even mild or non-symptomatic cases may have lung damage. And I think you just kind of answered that, so let me move on to the next one. How does the coronavirus compare to the influenza virus in terms of morbidity and mortality? Can you quantify it? For example, is it 2 times as deadly, 10 times, about the same?
I would say that it depends on the season and the flu, but probably about 10 times at least more severe than influenza.
Okay. With some studies suggesting that the antibodies don't provide immunity against COVID-19 for very long, possibly just months, how will vaccine manufacturers know how long their vaccine will provide immunity, or will people receive the vaccine and the immunity level will have to be determined at some future point?
That is a great question. And this is why it's being studied, and this is why we don't just make a vaccine and not do very rigorous studies moving forward. I think that we will see over time and that people will be repeatedly tested for antibody production, and this may be a vaccine where a single dose or 2 doses in a short period of time may not be enough, and that we may need multiple booster shots over time, or we may need it annually like we do influenza. I think there's a lot to learn here.
Okay. Do we have a reliable antibody test yet?
There are many different antibody tests that are available on the market. There are some that are better than others, but we do have some that we do feel like are generally reliable. some of the challenges with the tests are if you test too early in disease, you may have not made antibodies, so it wouldn't be reliable that way. Also, I think when we're testing populations that are low risk, there's always a chance of a false positive test, and those are issues with some of these tests as well. But in general, we have some pretty reliable tests.
And one came in right after them wanting to know how reliable or how accurate, the question says, is a negative antibody test?
Really, the question is, I think that there are a number of factors that go into that. So if you truly had COVID, and again, if you test too early, you may not have not made antibodies. There's some suggestion that people with more mild disease may not have not had a positive antibody test. And then, just as I think one of your callers had mentioned, I think we still don't know over time how long, even when your antibody becomes positive, how long it'll last for.
Okay, maybe I can ask you a sidebar here to talk for a moment about this antigen test. The FDA gave an emergency use authorization to Becton Dickinson today for this. And this sounds exciting on the surface. It's a test that gives a result in 15 minutes. It uses a machine that apparently is all over the place, kind of a cell phone-sized device, could widely expand the testing. So explain how antigen tests work and what you know about this one.
Great. So the test that most people are aware of in terms of diagnosis is PCR, where we're actually looking at pieces of DNA, RNA of the virus. Antibody test is actually looking at your body's immune system response. So it's actually looking at antibodies that your immune system made. Antigen tests are still looking at particles, pieces of the virus. I need to look at the specific test that you're talking about, but there I know of the antibody test, excuse me, of the antigen test that has come out a number of weeks ago. I think that although the speed, the rapidity of getting the result is very exciting, the sensitivity or the ability to get a correct positive test was lower, and so I need to look at that data. But that was one of the concerns of one of the recent antigen tests, was that although you could get it back really fast, that it was not as sensitive or it did not have the same ability to pick up positive results as the PCR test.
And of course, the positive results, the sensitivity is so crucial, right? Okay, next question. Why can't the statistics regarding testing, positive percentages, ICU beds remaining, et cetera, be reported in per capita figures so we could better compare, for example, Santa Clara County to Contra Costa to San Francisco? The raw numbers are good for curiosity, but because the county is very so much in geographical size and population, it makes a comparison difficult. Thank you.
I agree. I think more data and looking at it in lots of different ways would be helpful, and I think the point's very reasonable.
Okay, next one. What is your recommendation if I was to go camping in an open campsite? Others will be in the campground, but tents will be socially distanced. What would be the right protocol?
I think that the standardized practice of masking and social distancing, hand washing should all be at play. Obviously, I'm assuming the people that you're camping with are people that you normally are in regular contact with. I think, you know, again, good hand hygiene, distancing, masking whenever you can, and definitely if you seem to be, for some reason, closer than 6 feet.
Okay. Next question. I've not heard anything regarding protection from the virus through droplets into the eyes, although I've heard the virus can be passed on through the mouth, nose, and eyes. Should we be wearing face masks or shields, too, along with mouth coverings?
In the healthcare setting, we've been using, directly exposed to patients, we have been using face masks as part of our personal protective equipment. I think in the average community setting, that the addition of a face mask, probably the benefit, there's probably not a lot of benefit for doing that.
Okay. As a retired health professional, I'd like you to ask your guests to please discuss the long-term effects of COVID-19, especially as it affects youngsters who are currently behaving recklessly and irresponsibly, thereby seriously affecting their quality of life or maybe significantly shortening it. It appears time for an informative, emphatic, concerted public service campaign. So younger people, do they bounce right back from this?
I can tell you, looking at the data and our experience at UCSF, that we definitely have younger patients who get ill in the ICU. Younger people can die of this disease. I think that it's really important on several levels to remember, one, that as a younger person, you still are capable of getting severe disease and dying, but then also remembering that you are a vector and that you can carry this and give it to other people who are at risk, and that this isn't just wearing a mask is going to do so much at helping preventing the spread of disease to other people, your loved ones. You can do a very small thing to make a big difference to help us control this epidemic.
Okay. Next question. From a recent New England Journal of Medicine article, our genetic data confirmed that blood group O is associated with a risk of acquiring COVID-19 that was lower than that in non-O blood groups, whereas blood group A was associated with a higher risk than non-A blood groups, researchers concluded. There's a lot here about what the theory on this is. And the question here, do you have any info as to those who have dominant A positive recessive O negative genes? That is, does recessive O genetics help in any way?
I don't think it's really well understood why those blood group associations exist. I agree. I've read the article. I know exactly what they're talking about. But the why is not understood, and I don't think I really have much else to add to that question.
There's a lot that's still floating around out there. Here's one that follows up on a question that we had the other day, and this was the suggestion to conduct a comparative vaccine trial in the prisons with volunteer staff and inmates. And at the time, our response, I think this might have been Dr. Bob Wachter, who said it would be unethical to throw prisoners into a test like that. Now this questioner wants to know, what if the test didn't involve a placebo? Let's say you compared Moderna, Pfizer, Oxford, and Roche, and all the other vaccine candidates versus the outcome of those who didn't volunteer to take a vaccine at all. Would this be ethical, and could it be a way of looking at a vaccine more quickly?
I agree with what Dr. Wachter said. I didn't hear the interview, but that involving anybody in the correctional facility space in research studies is not something that we do or is considered ethical. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Next question. It would help if we really knew where the new cases were coming from. In other words, did people get it at a bar or a political protest or the supermarket, et cetera? Is this something the public health departments know but aren't saying, or is it impossible to determine?
I'm sure that the public health department is not keeping information, and I don't think we know specifically where outbreaks are always coming from. I mean, they work really hard to do tracking, but I think there are probably certain situations, there's certain living situations like nursing homes where there's lots of data of severe outbreaks resulting in a lot of morbidity and mortality, but we don't always know where these are coming from.
Okay. I live in San Francisco. Should I be worried about the reports about increasing hospital bed utilization? What's the situation at SF General?
I think in San Francisco at this time, we are having some more cases, some locally, some are coming from other areas where we're helping to care for patients where other health centers are becoming overwhelmed. I think we're still in fine shape, and we have our capacity is okay.
Okay. A couple more quick ones and we'll let you go. Do we need to continue to use disinfectant wipes on, say, packages from Amazon or FedEx?
I think every person has their certain level of risk that they're comfortable with. I think that doing that is reasonable. Also, there's a time where the virus will just stop being able to be transmissible. I think I was reading an article where Anthony Fauci said that he just leaves all his stuff for 2 days out on the table before he touches it. I think overall the risk of transmission from that mechanism is very, very low, but each individual needs to do what feels right for them. I would say I personally do not spray my Amazon containers before I open them.
Okay.
I wash my hands a lot.
Well, there's the answer, right? Okay. Next one. Will the use of sanitizer and toilet water eliminate or mitigate the risk of a virus being spread from toilet plume aerosols when flushing a public toilet? Basically, can I spray down the water with some blue porta potty stuff and stop the virus from spreading?
I am not. I don't think we have any data to suggest that this is the way that the virus is spread, and I don't think that that's necessary.
Okay, and I guess I'll leave you with this last one, which says, I'm not trying to start a political fight here, but President Trump says 99% of coronavirus cases are harmless. Would you agree?
No.
And on that note, we'll let you go. Thanks so much for the time this morning, Dr. Schwartz.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, take care. You too. That is Dr. Brian Schwartz, a physician specializing in the treatment of infectious diseases. He is a professor at the UCSF School of Medicine and is affiliated with Zuckerberg SF General Hospital. That'll do it for this morning's edition of Ask an Expert. I know there are questions we didn't get to, and they kind of come in right at the end. I apologize for that. We'll make sure we get them lined up for future guests. I do know that tomorrow we're going to focus on online learning, as so much has been said and written about it, and nervousness is growing among parents and teachers alike about how school is going to work this fall. We'll be talking with an expert from one of the nation's big teacher training colleges, the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College at Arizona State University. Dr. Leanna Archambault will be with us tomorrow morning. So any questions you may have, maybe you're coming from the perspective of a parent or maybe from that of a teacher about online learning, what we know works, what we know doesn't work, and what we're likely to see in the fall. Tomorrow will be the day to get that asked. And as always, the email address is askus@kcbsradio.com. Our expanding archive of segments is online at kcbsradio.com/askanexpert, including the audio of each day's episode as well as a text transcript.